This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
The views expressed on this medical roundtable do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
COVID booster shots have been approved for some groups. This, as many parents await approval for the COVID vaccine for kids under 12. And flu season is upon us. We'll take a look at what to expect. These are some of the stories making headlines this week. Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist that practices the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville, and this is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. And we want to hear from you. If you have a question, comment, or story idea, tweet me at jservin, email us at health@wjct.org, or leave us a message at 904-358-6362. Just ahead, we'll take a look at some of the biggest healthcare headlines with our first monthly medical roundtable. Then later, stories from the ICU. A critical care doctor shares his perspective on why we need to bring humanity back into the ICUs. But first, we're excited to welcome you to our first medical roundtable where we will discuss the latest healthcare developments. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Sunil Joshi. He's the Duval County Medical Society Foundation President and President of the Family Allergy Asthma Consultants. Mr. Chad Nielsen, who is Director of Accreditation and Infection Prevention at the UF Health Jacksonville. And Dr. Michelle Aquino, a hospitalist at Baptist Health Jax and Action News Jax's medical correspondent. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
So let's begin with COVID boosters, which were just approved for specific groups by the CDC and the FDA. Now, the CDC recommends that people aged 65 years and older and residents aged 18 years and older in long-term care settings and people aged 50 to 64 years with underlying medical conditions should receive a booster shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. Moreover, you should have completed the first series, the first two shots, or the first two doses at least 6 months ago. And they also recommend that the following groups may receive a booster shot of that Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine at least 6 months after they've gotten their completion done. And those groups include people aged 18 to 49 years with underlying medical conditions, and they are a long list of medical conditions, and as well as people who are aged 18 to 64 years who are at an increased risk for COVID-19 exposure and transmission because of their occupational or institutional settings. Let me remind you, these recommendations only apply to people who previously received a Pfizer-BioNTech primary series or the first two doses. So Dr. Aquino, why is it important for people in these groups to get the booster?
Well, because if they're still alive 6 months after getting their first shot, then that means the shot is working for them. It's keeping them hopefully from getting severe disease and dying from COVID, which is the point of the vaccine. So getting a booster is going to help keep their immunity levels up. And so that's the key. We want to protect these people. These are the highest risk individuals. And again, we want to keep them safe.
Let me ask you, what are you telling your patients who are asking for that booster at this time?
Well, I will tell you that most patients that have been vaccinated that I am seeing in the hospital are there for other reasons. And what I mean by that is when you're in the hospital and you're getting a mild procedure, we always have to test you for COVID if you're in the hospital for that. So when we test them, some of them will come back positive. And so they've been vaccinated, but they are a positive case at that moment. So they are asymptomatic COVID cases, which we're seeing, you know, we're seeing some of that. Those are breakthrough cases. And these people are having COVID without even knowing they have COVID, which again, just shows the vaccines do work. So a lot of these people, we're not really concerned about them getting their boosters because, you know, they listen to us, they listen to the recommendations. And so once, you know, they're done with their surgeries or whatnot, and they're out of the hospital, they're definitely going to get their boosters. And remember, I'm only in the hospital. I only see hospitalized patients. I am not in clinic where I see people that are in good, normal health. I usually see you when you're really sick in the hospital. I want to stress that.
Got it. I appreciate it. Chad Nielsen, what about those who receive the Moderna vaccine or the J&J vaccine? Are they eligible?
Yeah, so at this point, the FDA is really only recommending those with Pfizer. That being the case, J&J and Moderna are seeking further approval for their own set of boosters, particularly J&J, as it was a one-shot series. So at this time, we're focusing on those who have been fully vaccinated with the Pfizer shot, but Moderna and J&J are likely to come in the future.
Chad, I want to follow with a listener question, and this is from Paul from Jacksonville, so thank you. If I got a Pfizer vaccine the first time, can my booster be Moderna or J&J?
Yeah, so what the CDC and other literature is starting to recommend is really sticking with an mRNA shot. So that being the case, Pfizer and Moderna are both mRNA vaccines. What we don't want to do is folks getting a Johnson & Johnson and mixing it with a previous series from Pfizer or Moderna, as it's a different modality of vaccine. So if you've had Pfizer and Moderna, the booster shot should be sticking with the same.
Would there be any harm, just to follow up on that question, if someone did do something like that?
Yeah, if somebody did mix sort of a Johnson & Johnson and either a Pfizer or a Moderna, there's not necessarily an expectation of harm. It's just that it's not been well researched or studied. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a different type of vaccine. It doesn't utilize mRNA strictly. It uses an adenovirus vector. And there's just not good data and research on that yet as to what happens if you mix them. But the expectation is it would not cause harm. You just might not see the maximum benefit from it.
Thank you. Dr. Joshi, regarding individuals who have additional risk factors, should we be thinking of this as a booster or really a third dose, and why?
And it really depends on what the risk factor is. So if the risk factor is that you are immunocompromised or you have an immune deficiency, for instance, then it is truly a third dose. And that's different than getting a booster. The third dose is recommended in folks who have an immune deficiency and are immune compromised 28 days after they were fully vaccinated. So it's not the 6 month to 8 month window that you're talking about for a booster. The booster is for the other individuals, the folks that are 65 years and up, as you had described earlier, the folks that may have underlying medical conditions that qualify to receive the booster. That's what's occurring at 6 months after the second dose was administered. And so there is a difference between a third dose versus a booster shot.
Let me follow up on this group of folks, these individuals who have an increased risk. If they had gotten the Moderna vaccine, are they also the ones that should also get a third dose of Moderna as well if they're in this a group of more vulnerable folks?
Yeah, and that's what the expectation would be. And as Chad had mentioned earlier, you know, there isn't a lot of data to suggest that it would be just as effective to mix and match there with that third dose or even with the booster dose. Would it hurt? No, there's no data to suggest that it would hurt, and there's no reason to think that it would hurt. But is it beneficial? Are you truly getting that booster by getting, you know, a different version of the vaccine? That's the question. And so we don't know the answer to that yet. So that's why, you know, the FDA, the bigger public health message is to stick with the same vaccine.
I'm glad you underscored that, because that I think is a huge point to not let that be your barrier.
Yes, absolutely.
Chad, a listener question from Avondale. will we end up needing annual COVID booster shots, especially those of us over 60? Thank you for that question.
Yeah, I think it's an important question and one that we have to continue to examine moving forward. Certainly, most individuals are aware we have a new flu shot that comes out every year based on the different circulating strains of influenza across the world. And as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to roll on, potentially into its third year as of January, we have to be prepared for the idea that continued mutations and continued strains popping up on the scene could cause us to have annual vaccinations in the future of COVID until the pandemic is over, or until the virus burns itself out. So it's definitely a possibility, but to say with 100% certainty, we can't right now. We just have to continue to watch the data as the pandemic evolves.
Speaking of groups that a lot of people are wanting to know more about with regards to the vaccine, let's kind of move to the concept of when they might approve the vaccine for kids under 12. According to a statement from the FDA leadership, the FDA is, quote, working around the clock to support the process for making COVID-19 vaccines available for children. This process is complex and relies on robust manufacturer trials and data, and while we cannot offer a specific date or timeline for when it may be completed for the various manufacturers' vaccine candidates, we can assure the public we are working as expeditiously as possible to meet this critical public health need, and we very much hope to have pediatric COVID-19 vaccines available in the coming months. Until we authorize or approve a vaccine for this younger population, it's especially important that parents and others who interact closely with children under 12 years of age get vaccinated, wear masks, and follow other recommended precautions so that we may protect those who cannot yet protect themselves through vaccination. Meanwhile, Pfizer and German partner BioNTech released data from a clinical trial showing that their vaccine is safe and effective for children age 5 to 11 as at one-third of the dose given to adolescents and adults. Moreover, all of this comes at a time when we have a new Surgeon General for Florida. Dr. Joseph Latipo has impressive credentials, having earned his MD from Harvard Medical School, a PhD in health policy from that university's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. And before coming to Florida, he was an associate professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. However, Latipo is also known for downplaying the benefits of mask wearing, openly condemning business and school lockdowns, and his controversial views on vaccines. And since his nomination, the state issued a new rule leaving COVID exposure quarantine up to parents. So after that, Chad, a listener from Jacksonville writes, when should we really expect COVID vaccines to be available for kids?
Well, I think we have to follow the indications from the CDC and the FDA in saying that we should expect them for that certain age group, 5 to under 12s here, imminently. And from what we know from the manufacturers of the vaccines, from Pfizer, as well as the FDA, they are making plans to also present their data for EUA approval for the under fives as well here potentially by the end of the calendar year. So I do believe it's imminent. Now, whether or not that's going to be widely available throughout all pharmacies and hospital clinics and non-hospital-based clinics is to be determined, right? So we have to see what the dosage is going to be on these for kids. So there might be a little bit of a lag time from when they say it's EUA approved to when you can actually get your kids vaccinated under that 12-year-old age. But it is coming, and I think everybody needs to be prepared for that here in the next coming month.
Dr. Aquino, a listener from Arlington, asks, I want to jump the gun and get my child vaccinated. Is there any risk?
There is a risk with everything, right?
Right.
I tell patients, you take Tylenol and aspirin, there's a risk with that. There's always a risk. So obviously there's always a risk, but I would definitely encourage that parent to not do that yet. Because again, when you're dealing with these younger kids, you know, we're talking 11 and under,
right.
These kids, it's so different. You can have a 10-year-old, you know, that has the body of a 16-year-old in terms of weight, and you can have a 10-year-old who's tiny and is more like a 5-year-old, right? in this age group of these young kids, they just, there's so much diversity in height and weight and all that. And I think when the kids get younger for the vaccines, it is going to be weight-based. So I would highly encourage this parent to please wait until we get recommendations, because you do not want to give your child something that we don't know how they will be affected by it. And I also want to commend this parent for being proactive and really wanting to get their, you know, their child vaccinated and keep them safe. I appreciate that.
Now, here, here, I agree with that completely. Dr. Joshi, a listener from Atlantic Beach, writes, does the appointment of a new Florida Surgeon General really impact what happens next with the COVID pandemic in kids? The truth is, I can't even remember the last person to hold that role.
That's a good question.
Thank you for that.
There has been somebody, you know, holding the role. But in terms of whether or not that makes an impact in terms of how the vaccine gets distributed, I certainly hope not, you know, because as we've already discussed, it's imminent for the vaccine to have approval sometime in this month, hopefully, because there's a lot of talk about trying to get the vaccine rolled out before Halloween. So it is imminent, and how it gets rolled out, I think that the state surgeon general may play a role in that, but it should not change our belief in the vaccine, the need for the vaccine, and our quickest way to get out of this pandemic is for us to have as many people vaccinated as possible, and that does include our children.
Chad, any idea when they do approve a vaccine for kids, whether they'll roll it out all at once for kids under 12, or will they stagger it further by different age groups, depending on, you know, less than 2 years or something in that manner?
Yeah, I mean, the indications at this point is that they will set a strict age range on that, and then they'll roll it out all at once based on availability of clinics, hospitals, and other types of providers to get that shot. So I wouldn't expect a phased-in approach, quite like we had seen before with focusing on 65s and up and long-term care patients. I think once they release this vaccine, the indications are that it's going to be open for anyone within that age group to go at any time and get that based on supply availability.
Chad, one other quick follow-up. I mentioned the results from Pfizer and pediatric vaccines. Do we have any word on Moderna or J&J for kids?
Yes, Moderna is working on their trial data right now. So as we've told the public before previously, the FDA requires a more lengthy trial period with more data to be submitted when looking at vaccines for kids. In fact, they require for EUA approval double the amount of trial vaccine data to submit for that EUA approval. So it's taking Moderna a little bit longer, just as they came second in that sort of race in America to get their EUA approval after Pfizer, such is the same. So Moderna is working on it. I'm not currently aware if J&J is as well versus working on their booster shots. But we know Moderna is in the pipeline to get theirs also EUA approved, but probably not until after the first of the year.
Okay. Dr. Joshi, what can kids under the age of 12, their parents and school employees do to protect themselves until the vaccine is approved?
Yeah, I think even what's critical here is that the parents themselves need to be vaccinated. Their older siblings need to be vaccinated as well. That's one way to protect our younger children who are not eligible yet to get the vaccine from being exposed to the virus. But also, you know, as we've talked about previously, wearing masks have made an impact previously in previous years, and have certainly made an impact here in Duval County recently. And there are some studies that suggest that you're 3.5 times more likely to see outbreaks of COVID-19 in schools that do not have a mask mandate versus counties in which schools do. And that was just data from Arizona that the CDC published very recently. And so there is definitely some data suggesting that the mitigation strategies, vaccinations, in particular for our youngest group of children, those who have not yet been vaccinated, is the way to protect them in the meantime.
Dr. Aquino, how concerned are you about the quarantine becoming optional, especially in mask mandate free districts like St. John's, given the fact that some folks have asymptomatic cases?
Yeah, and are you asking that to me? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was asking Dr. Aquino. I apologize.
Okay. Yeah, so this is one of these lovely new things that are happening in Florida since we have Dr. DeLandapo being our Surgeon General. That I think what they're saying is, if your child gets sent home because of a COVID exposure, it is up to the parent to decide when they can return to school if they have no symptoms. And so what's concerning about that is, remember, when you get exposed to COVID, it takes your body about 4, 5, 6 days to really develop, you know, the infection, and for you to have symptoms and for you to say, oh, I think something's wrong. I feel sick. Let me get tested. So I just sense a lot of these parents are going to be returning kids to school much earlier than we normally should. You know, right now, the isolation period for kids once they're sent home is usually about 7 days. And that gives, you know, a parent enough time to see if their kid develops symptoms. But right now, with this, you know, idea that the parent can decide when the kid goes back to school, that is concerning, because we're going to return kids back to school that possibly have COVID, don't know they have COVID yet, and they're just going to go back into the mix and get more kids sick. So, yes, definitely extremely concerning.
Yeah, there's not much that one can add to that other than just to underscore it. Dr. Joshi, can Dr. LaDapo influence state or private hospital policies requiring staff to be faxed?
You know, that's a good question. You know, how much government, you know, reach is there when it comes to this? Right now, private entities are, especially hospitals, are requiring their staff to be vaccinated. And you know, the state may try to influence that in a variety of different ways, much like they have tried to influence masks in schools, et cetera. But ultimately, the hospital needs to do what's in its best interest, which is to have medical professionals available to treat patients who come into the hospital. And you can't do that if they're out because they tested positive for COVID or because they're sick from COVID. And it also then is a way to keep our patients safe as well. You know, the patients need to know that their practitioners who are helping them in the hospital have been protected against the flu as well as against COVID-19. Keep in mind that we're required to get the flu shot to work in the hospital as well. So this is not necessarily something that's new.
This is a perfect transition point. And while we're on the subject of flu, I guess the question that everyone's wondering is, what will this year's flu season look like? And what plans are local medical officials making to address it? You know, in the fall of 2020, when most people were wearing masks, social distancing, and washing their hands to avoid COVID-19, those safety measures also helped all of us avoid getting the flu. However, much of the population has since abandoned some, if not all, of these safety measures. And since not as many people got the flu last year, few built up immunity to the illness. According to the CDC, reduced population immunity due to lack of flu virus activity since March 2020 could result in an early and possibly severe flu season. So now there's a push for the flu vaccine to control outbreaks during the 2021 and 22 season, which runs from November through March, and avoid the prospect of a twindemic with the flu and COVID-19. So, Dr. Joshi, since you brought this up, you've relaunched FluVax Jax again this year. Can you tell us why and what you're hoping to accomplish there?
Well, again, number one, it is to encourage people to be vaccinated against the flu. But part of this is to educate people about the safety and effectiveness of this vaccine. And it was critically important last year, but it seems like it's even more important this year. Last year, we didn't have a COVID vaccine available, and we were trying to do what we can to prevent a quote-unquote twindemic, as you just described, of having people in the hospital because of COVID, but also having people in the hospital because of the flu, and getting us to the point where we were over capacity. Luckily, that did not happen last year, and we did increase flu vaccination rates in Northeast Florida by 30% last year, as well, just by educating folks. This year, we're taking the same approach, except this time we have reached a very high levels of hospitalizations for COVID-19, and understanding that the flu does put people in the hospital as well, and the vaccine is a way to keep folks out of the hospital, this becomes even more important. And so we know that the data suggests that adults over the age of 65 who are vaccinated against the flu are 80% less likely to require an ICU admission, and children who are vaccinated against the flu are 72% less likely to require hospital admission if they were to develop the flu. It becomes important to get that word out and get as many people vaccinated as possible, because as you increase the percentage of people vaccinated, you decrease the risk of hospitalization logarithmically, not linearly. So it is important to do that. This FluVaxJax campaign is also important because, as has been mentioned earlier, though the COVID vaccine is free, the flu vaccine is not free. And so if you have private insurance, it is free. If you do not, if you're an uninsured individual, you're paying out of pocket for the flu shot when you go to your local grocery store or pharmacy for it. And the FluVaxJax initiative does have a way to provide free flu vaccine vouchers for the uninsured so that cost does not become a limiting factor in receiving the flu vaccine this year.
That is so huge, and what an important role that has. Chad Nielsen, can you talk us through this whole idea of the concept of, okay, we have two viruses and this issue of virus displacement? In other words, where one, what happens when you have two big circulating viruses in a population? Does one win? Do they both occur? Where do you see, can you kind of guide us or navigate that issue for us?
Yeah, it's certainly complicated epidemiology to look at two sort of competing viruses. Generally speaking, there's a lot of factors that are involved in how those viruses continue to spread through the population. Are there mitigation factors that are better for one versus the other? And truthfully, when we look at flu versus COVID, very different viral illnesses. But we know that year to year, there's a certain percentage effectiveness of the flu vaccine, which if bolstered by mitigating factors like masking, hand washing, things like that, it's very effective. Similar to COVID-19, we know that versus last year, we have an extremely effective vaccine to stave off COVID hospitalization, severity, and death. And so when you look at the interplay between the two and the replacement theory, there's just a lot of different factors that go into displaying whether or not there's going to be a greater number of one versus the other. And at this point, we're just not sure what that's going to look like. Given that we don't have many mitigating factors out in the broad public, as you pointed out last year, there was a lot of hand washing, a lot of masking in public, and a lot of working from home going on. We don't have that this year. And so some of those things that were in place last flu season are lacking this year due to a different phase or a different approach on the pandemic, which will allow flu to make somewhat of a comeback if we're not getting vaccinated. So I think it's important that the public knows we will see a greater number of influenza cases this year. Anecdotally, from my own hospital, we have already started to see influenza A positive cases. So we do think there's going to be a rebound in flu. Whether or not that's going to displace COVID is just too early to tell. But we know that with every further mutation that COVID takes, it could risk us getting into a new wave. So the best thing we can do at this point is say, get your COVID vaccination on board if you haven't already, and go ahead and get that flu shot on board too.
Dr. Aquino, how do you tell the difference between flu and COVID?
That's a great question. And before I answer that, I want to state for everyone listening, if you go get a COVID vaccine and get the flu shot, you can get them at the same time. It's very important information from everyone to know. You can get the flu and a COVID vaccine or a COVID booster at the same time. All right, that's key. So you get sick, you have a runny nose, you have a headache, you have a fever, you're achy. Do you have the flu or do you have COVID? That is a great question. And at this juncture, I think going forward, we're all just going to have to check for both when you have any of those symptoms. Right. You know, I know that earlier with COVID, the initial COVID, when we'd see hospitalized patients, a lot of them would say, you know, my symptoms began with just shortness of breath. I just couldn't breathe well. I couldn't take a deep breath. And then I started having fever. Some people got abdominal pain, a little bit of diarrhea. And that's the COVID that we saw, the symptoms of COVID, which, of course, you know, you have the lack of taste and lack of smell. So those were initial COVID symptoms. This time around with Delta, the symptoms are a little bit different. They really are. We're seeing a lot more headache, a lot more sore throat, a lot more runny nose. So a lot more URI, you know, flu-like symptoms are the symptoms we're seeing now with Delta, not just the, you know, the fevers and the shortness of breath. So I think the bottom line is if you're having any of those symptoms, we really have to be wary, number one. Number two, you definitely need to figure out what you have and start isolating. Don't expose yourself to other people. You know, right now, I know that we have these over-the-counter COVID tests that are fairly accurate, especially if you're having symptoms. I think the accuracy is somewhere between 86 to 96%. So that's a good option, I think, in the beginning. If you're having symptoms, get an over-the-counter test, check yourself. If COVID is negative, great. You might have the flu. And that's kind of the way we're going to have to go, you know, through this flu season with COVID still hanging around. We're going to have to deal with all these symptoms.
Chad Nielsen, we have a listener question from Southside, and they ask, do you think we're coddling our immune systems to the point that we just can't fight flu?
The short answer to that is no. There is this idea of the hygiene hypothesis that when we expose ourselves to pathogens early on, it builds a stronger immune response. But that ignores the reality that by not taking preventative measures like vaccines, like mitigating factors of social distancing and masking, there will be deaths and there will be severe illness that follows if we don't take these measures. So taking a vaccine should not be seen as coddling your immune system. Vaccines are proven effective public health measures to prevent unnecessary illness and death. And so we've been taking flu shots every year for decades now, and it has largely blunted the number of individuals in America that have died from the flu shot or died from the flu illness.
Right.
And so we see that with COVID. The COVID vaccines are extremely effective at preventing severe illness and death. And so that's the public health measure we should be taking, and it shouldn't be seen as something that is going to derail us or affect our immune system. It's a booster to our immune system. That's what it's there for, and that's what's going to prevent us from losing more lives, whether it's flu or COVID.
Let's take a moment to acknowledge the impact all of this is having on healthcare workers, especially this last COVID surge. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 4 million Americans quit their jobs in July 2021. They're calling it the Great Resignation. Resignations peaked in April and have remained abnormally high for the last several months, with a record-breaking 10.9 million open jobs at the end of July. Now, while resignations decreased slightly in industries like manufacturing and finance, 3.6% more healthcare employees quit their jobs than in the previous years, typically among employees who worked in fields that had experienced extreme increases in demand due to the pandemic, likely leading to increased workloads and burnout. So, Dr. Joshi, what toll has all of this taken on the mental health of medical professionals?
Well, even before COVID-19 came around, medical professionals have been dealing with burnout and even suicidal thoughts and depression and all of that. This pandemic has, of course, accelerated that significantly because it's not only that there's a burden of us trying to keep our patients healthy and out of the hospital, and those that are in the hospital, get them out of the hospital without dying from this virus. It's been the fact that, there's more and more people coming into the hospital, becomes more and more difficult, and folks that are sick from COVID are not able to come into work. So suddenly there's even more burden on healthcare providers and those, who are able to show up for work. And so it's become very, very challenging for all of us just from the aspect of taking care of patients. But then you also look at all the misinformation that's out there that we, the three of us on this call for sure, are battling on a day-to-day basis. Misinformation about the virus, misinformation about testing, misinformation about the vaccines, and misinformation about masks. I mean, we go on and on and on about ways that healthcare professionals are trying to mitigate the spread and keep people healthy, yet we keep having to fight with misinformation about ways to do this, ways to accomplish this. That's adding to the emotional toll and the burden that we all feel during this pandemic. And so it has been significant. As a medical society, we're doing what we can to reach out to individuals here locally, especially the physicians and other healthcare professionals, to have an outlet in case they get to that point where they're burning out or even worse, are getting to the point where they feel like hurting themselves.
I wondered if you can comment. Are healthcare institutions here locally, are you seeing a loss of healthcare staff? And more importantly, what can we do to reverse this, if anything?
Yeah, and again, that's a difficult question to answer, in terms of what can we do. What we can do is let science dictate how we manage this pandemic. That in itself would make a significant impact in the mental health well-being of all of us that are managing these patients and trying to get the right information out there so that we can focus on our job, which is keeping people safe and healthy, as opposed to constantly having to manage misinformation. And so I think that's part of the challenge. In terms of what the hospitals are seeing in terms of physicians or other healthcare providers burning out, I think that's better for the folks that work in hospitals to answer that. But we as a medical society have a way for folks to reach out. It's a telephone call where we can put them in contact with counselors when they are in need. And the foundation or Medical Society Foundation pays for that. And we know that we have been seeing an uptick in calls as a result of this pandemic. But in terms of what the hospitals are seeing, I'll let the other two comment on.
Dr. Aquino?
Yeah, I can comment on this fairly well, as we've been in the front line of the pandemic in the hospital taking care of COVID patients. I just finished 7 days straight on the COVID ward. So All my patients were COVID. And I'll tell you that in the beginning of this pandemic, treating COVID patients was actually, it felt very rewarding because there was a lot of unknown. We didn't have a vaccine and people were just extremely appreciative of anything that you can do to help them feel better. And there was a lot of conversation, COVID patients, you spend a lot of time discussing all the information. So, you'd go in there and say, okay, we have this. We think it'll help. We're not sure, but it shouldn't hurt. And then we have this, we would say the same thing over and over. Mind you, we didn't have a lot of options. The patients overall were extremely appreciative, especially if we were able to get you home, not dying in the hospital from COVID. We also have to add in there significant amount of anxiety, significant amount of distress just from everything everyone's heard. Once they get hospitalized with COVID, they're just sitting in a room thinking of all these terrible things they've heard about having COVID and how many people die. So now fast forward to this Delta peak that we've had since end of June, and it's decreasing. We're still pretty busy at the hospital, but it's definitely decreasing now. We've reached our Delta peak and it's coming down. This Delta peak has been very eye-opening in a different way, and this is where I think a lot of our burnout is happening in the hospital, because now we're dealing with a patient population, for the most part, 90% of patients are unvaccinated, right, for this Delta peak across the United States.
Right.
And so the majority of COVID patients we're dealing with now that need to be hospitalized for COVID are unvaccinated. These are people that, because of a misinformation, which I think, by the way, is the number one killer of people right now for COVID, because of misinformation and their beliefs and who they listen to, they end up in the hospital very sick. All right. Delta is a nasty, nasty COVID virus. It's like the original COVID on steroids. That's the way I describe it. It's just nasty. The first two waves, I'd see sicker people get sick. Some of them died. Yes, we saw that. Rarely saw young people. This third wave with Delta, I've regularly had 19-year-olds in the hospital, 23-year-olds, 24-year-olds. I had a 32-year-old I took care of this week. Otherwise, healthy people in the hospital with COVID. So going back to the unvaccinated, when patients have so much misinformation, they have, there's a wariness and they are so concerned and there's so significant amount of mistrust. And when you go into the room and your only goal is to go in there, explain to the patient what you're doing for them, how you hope to get them better and get them through the process, and they start arguing with you and questioning everything you're doing because they don't believe that you know what you're doing, that's frustrating. That leads to burnout.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
At that point, I should not have to sit there and tell you what my training is and why I am qualified to treat COVID. So dealing with that is extremely frustrating. And just the misinformation is frustrating. A lot of these patients, they don't trust you for the first part of the hospitalization as they're all very, very sick. And as they slowly start getting better, then they sort of listening to you a little bit. And I'll say at the end of the hospitalization, if we are able to get you home, at that point, that's when I say, okay, let's talk about vaccines. That's I just very open-ended. What do you think about them? And then we start having, the conversation. So I think there's so much burnout because, again, what I just explained is, imagine every day with every patient you're seeing for COVID. I had to do that 18 times every day this week, right. All my patients, right? Wow. We go in there, the newer ones, it's a lot harder. The ones I've been taking care of for a few days that are getting better, it gets a little bit easier, but it's just like this burden that's put on us healthcare workers on having to deal with all this misinformation and try to get patients past this because we just want to get you better. You know, and I'm going to share one real quick personal story with you all.
Yeah, as we're in our last minute here.
When you're in the hospital, you work for a certain amount of days and you have a certain few days off. And usually when you come back on your next cycle, you look up all the patients you took care of the last time you were in the hospital to see how everyone did. I can tell you that most of us right now working on COVID in these last few weeks, we don't do that anymore. It's too depressing. Every time I would look back at the patients I took care of previously, so many were dying that it's just too depressing to look at. Honestly, that's right. One thing that I know that has changed the way I take care of patients right now. I don't look at my last patients I took care of. It's too sad to see how many people are dying from COVID.
I appreciate you sharing that very firsthand account there, Dr. Kino. My heart goes out because I know that is such a huge issue for all the workers out there and you know, thank goodness that you're all here helping us out. That kind of wraps up this portion of our roundtable. Doctors Joshi, Chad Nielsen, Dr. Aquino, thank you for coming on the show. It's a terrific trio that we had here. And up next, a doctor's journey through the lens of critical care and what he has learned along the way about intensive care units and their need to change. With the ongoing COVID pandemic, no other area of medicine has been placed front and center than ICUs or intensive care units. In the United States alone, the average person will have more than one ICU stay in his or her lifetime. Although modern ICUs are technological medical marvels designed to save lives, in his new book, Every Deep Drawn Breath, Dr. Wes Ely notes that sometimes we forget that a stay in the ICU has the capacity to both save and ruin a patient's life. Joining us today to talk about it is the author himself. Dr. Wes Ely is a critical care medicine doctor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where he is a professor of medicine. Dr. Ely, it is a pleasure to have you here today for our interview. Thanks so much for speaking to me, and congratulations on an amazing book.
Dr. Servin, thank you so much. This book is a tribute to the patient's stories who are told in it. It's about their pain and suffering, but also about their joy. And if we can do something to amplify their stories so that all of us can do a better job of humanizing the relationships in our life, then I think that we will have done something good. And I appreciate you taking an interest.
No, it's our pleasure. So let's start off. And what made you decide to write this book? I mean, why now at this moment?
I think that COVID has really depersonalized many of our lives. Our parents and grandparents and children are all interacting with one another with masks on at the least, or maybe not even interacting in person at all. And this sort of distance has created a depressing situation for people, and we feel a lack of the human touch. And so what this book is about is, how do we reestablish that human touch? How do we humanize all of our relationships and experiences and lift each other up? And I was able to draw on 30 years of being a doctor, real people, real stories, real names. None of this is made up. And hopefully weave a story that will be really interesting to the average non-medical reader that makes them realize that we're making some real advances in care over the last 20 years and that we can do better. And so the reason I wrote the book is to wake us up, to help us do a better job on the patient and family side as advocates, but also on the medical side as doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, so that we can really lift up our patients' experiences and do the best job we can for them.
So Dr. Ely, let me kind of get into the things that you think that we need to wake us all up about. What are some of those big concerns that you have regarding ICU management right now?
A major concern is that all too often people think of ICUs as places where people are lying in bed, immobilized, sedated, and really people are put through a depersonalization chamber. You know, out in the world, we like music. We wear red clothes, blue clothes. We speak certain conversational dialects, et cetera. But in the ICU, if we sedate and immobilize all these people, it's just a world of gray zones. You know, and that sort of management became acceptable in the 90s and early 2000s. And we have proven through some very, very robustly designed scientific studies published in the New England Journal, JAMA, Lancet, et cetera, that that is not good for a human being, that it increases death, it increases length of stay, and it creates a situation, Dr. Servin, which I want the reader and the listener to know about, called PICS. Post-intensive care syndrome, or PICS. And they can read about this on our website, icudelirium.org, which is just an educational website. Patients with COVID who come in the ICU and receive this sort of care, just like the non-COVID patients, leave with a world of long COVID that changes the trajectory of their entire life. And we need to realize that when long after, months and years after they get out of the ICU, that they are not thinking clearly, they can't deal with the PTSD and the depression that's now entered into their life, and that we can do it better to help them recover and get back to their original self.
No, that makes perfect sense. And, you know, one of the things that I loved about this book was the fact that you told this story through patient stories, through all of the people you've encountered. I wondered if you could share with us, why did you choose to do it in that manner? And even for me, and I can imagine you saw many, many patients, how did you select these individual stories for the book?
I love that you asked me that. You know, sitting right in front of me here as I do this interview with you is my recorder. And I recorded all these people's conversations and had them transcribed. And what appears in the book are verbatim conversations that these patients are willing to share with the rest of the world. And you know, I'll just tell you one quick story. I remember a patient who came in the hospital with belly pain, and we took her to the OR, and we opened her up, and she was just completely full of cancer. There was no way to cure this problem. So she was closed back up, sent upstairs, and there in that room on that day, this woman told me this, "Dr. West, Dr. Ely, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God or an afterlife, but I want to talk to my family, and I have something I've dreamed about for many years, a ritual." And she proceeded to ask each one of those family members three times, "Do you love me?" And they would say back, "You know that I love you." And then each time she went through that, she gave them a hug and a kiss, and then she did something I never, ever thought she would do. She said, "Dr. Ely, you are in my inner circle now. Do you love me?" And she put me on the spot and asked if I loved her. And through that day, through the hours that I spent with her and that swirling, intense interaction, I had grown to love her, holding her hand, looking in her eyes. And these are the sorts of stories that I wanted to fill up the pages of Every Deep Drawn Breath, because we have to all realize each of us has an intimate role to play, different ways, but each of us can play a role in lifting another human being up. Whether or not you're in medicine or not, we all have relationships, and they can all be enhanced if we take this seriously and really focus on that person who's right in front of us.
That is so powerful. Wow, is all I can say, because I'm almost speechless from the power of that story. Dr. Ely, you know, we are in the midst of a pandemic. I know you are front and center given the work that you do. What parts of the ICU management style do you think we should be keeping, and what do you want to see fixed as we go past pandemic? When COVID is in the rearview mirror, what should the ICU management approach look like for all of us?
The parts of the ICU that we love in 2021 are the technological advances. We've got great ventilators. We've got an amazing ability to get people out of shock. But just last week, I published a study in Lancet Respiratory called the COVE Barrier Study, like COV barrier, like a barrier to COVID, in which we proved with an old rheumatoid arthritis drug called baricitinib, and I have no conflicts of interest, by the way, no stock, no money here, but we proved that that drug could save lives. So all these things, the technology, the medications, that's a keeper. But what's not a keeper is the way that we handle the human being who's receiving this care. What I want us to do is see the person in the patient, the person in that gown, in that bed. And the way to do that absolutely requires us to look in their eyes, wake them up, talk to them, and instead of saying to them, here's what's the matter with you, say, what matters to you? And find out with each individual person what matters the most to them, and then drop what we're doing to try and say, I will provide you the best technological care possible, and I will also pay attention to you as a person, mind, body, and spirit. And Dr. Servin, that is what I call our command towards beneficence. You know, benevolence is wanting to do good. Beneficence is actually doing good. And I know that I am guilty because many times in my life I have desired to help another person and not actually done so. So we came up with this program called the A2F bundle, ABCDEF bundle. It's like a safety checklist that a pilot would use to go across the country. And when we employ that, we get better overall care, better survival, and better recovery.
All I can hope is that when all is said and done, that all of these practices are brought to the forefront, and then we get to the vision that you've kind of placed out there. Dr. Wes Seely, thank you so much for joining us. We've been listening and talking to Dr. Wes Seely on his new book, Every Deep Drawn Breath. He is a critical care medicine doctor at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and a professor of medicine. To everyone, thank you so much for joining us. Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Have questions or comments or a medical question for a future show on what's health got to do with it? Call us at 904-358-6362 or send an email to health@wjct.org. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.